At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
All right, everybody. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whenever you're listening. Hopefully you're listening live. Today's going to be a pretty cool show. I've been on this guy's show a couple times. Always enjoyed talking to him, and him and I have very, very similar perspectives when it comes to the political discourse today. But I think he's a little bit more well-versed in more of the right wing of America today, perhaps, and then some other topics as well, which I'm sure we're going to cover. But like I said, I always enjoy talking to this guy, so I figured it would be time to bring him on after he had me on his show twice. So anyways, make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where you can find my guest, where you can find myself, everything I got going on. Tons of new projects in the works for me, but also tigerfitness.com through the link below. They're probably going to have a pretty killer 4th of July sale, and I know I'm going to spend more money than I probably should on supplements and stuff like that. So make sure you hit that link below and go to foxandsonscoffee.com. Use code Kyle at checkout to let Steven know I sent you and get some fantastic coffee as well. And I guess without further ado, let's rock and roll. All right, everybody, and look at that. We already got a fan in the chat. Nuclear Cadillo. Treat my boy Jose good. Jose, dude, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great, and yes, Nuclear Cadillo will be the chat MVP for tonight. The most important chat person.
Yeah, absolutely, man. He's awesome. Anyways, I gave you a little bit of an introduction, but why don't you let everybody know who you are, what you do, what you're known for, and all that good stuff, man?
Well, I've been in the political space since Ron Paul's second presidential campaign in 2007-2008, now well over 15 years. I am a freelance writer and podcaster as well. I write about a host of issues ranging from like immigration to foreign policy. I'm definitely on the right. I did start out as a doctrinaire libertarian, but my views have become more nuanced over time. But I still share a lot of the key principles with Ron Paul Republicans, such as like sound money and non-interventionist foreign policy. But these days, I tend to be more focused on civilizational issues such as mass migration and what I believe is a concerted assault by both the private and public sector to dispossess European Americans, aka whites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really a lot of the stuff that I enjoy talking about as well. I perhaps don't focus on that stuff as much as I perhaps could, but what kind of got you? Well, I know you were kind of big into Ron Paul at first. Mm. And I'm sure you still are, but you know, it seems like there's a lot of people, and I would perhaps be amongst this kind of group as well, that's kind of shifting, I don't even want to say away from Ron Paul libertarianism, but perhaps welcoming a little bit more nuance, like you said, into kind of our perspectives from like hardcore, you know, anarcho-capitalist libertarianism over to maybe a little bit more, I don't want to say right-wing authoritarian, but perhaps maybe a little bit more like small L, limited government conservatism.
So what I've noticed, and I noticed this in the Ron Paul campaign, and a lot of this is hindsight 2020 and just retrospective vision. But what I noticed in the Ron Paul campaign in 2008 and even 2012, a good deal of people that were flocking to him were not doctrinaire libertarians. Many of these people were members of the disgruntled middle American radicals, the term that the late Sam Francis, the conservative writer, coined. And these type of people are generally, they know what's going on. They know that something's wrong, really. That the whole system is corrupt, from the politics to the corporate system. It just stinks, and they instinctively know it. These people aren't always very ideological. I remember my times just going to like Minnesota, of all places, like during like Ron Paul events, where you could go to like the Iron Range or any area where there's strong union domination. Like, unions are generally assumed to be Democrats, but these same people were actually very receptive to Ron Paul's message because they hated banks. And they hated big finance, and they wanted to end wars. And a lot of them were also gun owners too. So what I've learned over time is that people are ultimately very tribal in nature, and they, generally speaking, in a moment of political crisis, they start to think more instinctually, not ideologically. They don't engage in all these mental gymnastics or ideological masturbation. They use their gut feelings to figure out that something is actually like fucked up. When you see like a dude in a girl's restroom, or whenever they see their once like 90% white neighborhood just turn into like a rice paddy, or looks like just like a scene from like sub-Saharan Africa. Like, it's just this kind of stuff is primordial in nature. And what I think is happening with a lot of libertarians, and even people in mainstream conservatism too, because there's a lot of overlap, and it's some of this stuff can get very incestuous, especially if you work in DC, because there's a very like strong culture that affects conservatives and libertarians equally, and I've seen it firsthand having worked there. That a lot of these people, once they start living in the real world, where like living in cities that have been just wrecked by diversity and all these like woke policies, and I've seen them just get hollowed out, that this entire system is corrupt to the core, and many of the solutions being offered are simply not that good, even some quote-unquote limited government and libertarian solutions. So people are starting to re-question things and going back to first principles, or they're going like literally way back to basics, to the times of the Greeks, to figure out some of these age-old political questions that have manifested themselves again and again. And what we're facing now is civilizational in nature, and I believe that many libertarians are becoming kind of like non-denominational populists, if you will. Not so much conservatives, but they're becoming like populists that are questioning everything from libertarianism itself to many of the foundational myths of like the American civic religion altogether. And that's why some of these people are gravitating towards full-blown authoritarianism. Some are gravitating towards secessionism. Some may also go like the anarcho-capitalist route, because I do think anarcho-capitalism in of itself is actually very anti-system. It does reject the present order. I don't agree with a lot of what it says, but I do think that is a permutation of libertarianism that is much more radical. And I'd argue it does dispel with a lot of the foundational myths of the current system.
Yeah, that's all really, really good stuff. And I, in fact, large part agree. I think to kind of add on to what you said there, that a lot of people are kind of gravitating away from, you know, anarcho-capitalist libertarianism, because it's almost like full-blown Marxism, right? Where it's, you know, when you start to talk to people about this, you really could walk up to, you know, the most ideologically possessed libertarian and ask them, well, you know, how would this work? How would that work? Or what would your society look like? How would you deal with this? And it's always like, okay, well, essentially either they're not a real libertarian, or real libertarianism has never been tried. Yeah. Which it always seems to kind of go back to that.
Yeah. Well, there are some similarities in the sense that both many forms of libertarianism and Marxism are economically reductionist, where everything is reduced to economic analysis and like transactional interactions, when I would contend that politics tends to be more organic, and questions of identity, blood and soil, and cultural norms are what, in my opinion, dictate things. Yeah, there's a lot of like theoretical masturbation and just like denial of certain political realities of what's going on and power politics altogether. But yes, I do think that when you look at libertarianism, especially the more like acceptable mainstream forms of it, it does mirror a lot of what the cultural left promotes these days. For example, you go to the Cato Institute, these guys are in lockstep with the neoliberal elites on mass migration. They love it. They want more of it. And some libertarians, they do like the idea of liberal democracy and spreading it through color revolutions, and even like are just flat out hawks on foreign policy, as people like Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute have demonstrated. But that is a question of our epoch, but that's also why I've my political project really is to like correct and refute the errors of the 20th century, which I believe has produced like the current state that we live in. And if we continue this course, the civilization that was built by the founding generation of predominantly Anglo-Saxon, Northern European extraction will just disappear into the ether and just in the latest line of once prosperous civilizations that just disappear. Like, say, like the Assyrians, Babylonians, blah, blah, blah. We'll be talking about the long lost tribes of the Euro-Americans 500 years from now. Well, CCP historians likely will be doing that, but yeah.
Well, it's kind of funny because the one thing that libertarians seem to leave out as well, and I think you were kind of getting at it there, is culture, because culture does matter. And I was listening to your podcast, I think it was Patrick Casey, where you guys were talking about immigration and had mentioned that, you know, way back in the day, there used to be immigration with periods of assimilation, where basically like these people would have to be, you know, kind of forced, I shouldn't even necessarily say forced, but kind of like moved into the American culture and then understand our values and then come to respect the land that they now inhabit. But when you have people who don't have family here, who don't have roots here, who weren't born here, who haven't paid taxes here for, you know, decades and haven't seen their family and their networks grow in this country, it's hard to feel like we have some, or like you have something that you're attached to, right? Like for me, I look at my dad, you know, his dad, and then even his grandfather, where they owned gas stations and automotive shops all throughout, you know, Creighton here in Pennsylvania. I have ties to this area because I have a network and people that like I love and that love me. When you just come to a country and you don't have anything like that, then really, what's your incentive to kind of not make it more welcoming to preserve it? Exactly.
Oh, yes. Actually, speaking of gas stations and auto stores, there was a really good, this reminds me of an article, I think it's by the Roger McGrath at Chronicles Magazine, which I recommend all people subscribe to. I think it's called Suicide by Illegal and Legal Migration, where this guy, Roger McGrath, he's a historian of the so-called Wild West, really the Old West, but he grew up in Southern California, like when it was predominantly white. And one thing he noticed straight up was that when he grew up, all the gas stations were pretty much operated by people of white European extraction, like overwhelmingly. But over time, through increased mass migration and even affirmative action loan programs that like the Small Business Administration promoted, these venues basically got like ethnically cleansed. Like nowadays, it's mostly you see like Indians and all sorts of people from the global south that run and manage these places. And so a lot of these people are actually quite hardworking, but it is like a form of demoralization at the end of the day when you see stuff that like your ancestors or your community built slowly get dispossessed through public policy, because no, these people did not just spontaneously arrive here, because immigration is ultimately a question of public policy, who the state lets in and theoretically who they are supposed to kick out. But to your point, the concept of like a rootless cosmopolitan is one of the stories of our epoch, because it's seen as almost passé to have like roots in your community to stay and actually try to develop it, because, and I'm guilty of this myself, it is very common for a young American professional to just be bouncing around the whole United States. Whether you're like born in Kansas, you'll be like going to LA, then Chicago, then taking a pit stop in Miami, and then going all over the place, not really establishing any roots. You're just renting stuff, living in the moment. Whereas back then, people generally stuck to their community, and they, and even if it was a very suboptimal economic livelihood, they at least made an effort to develop and cultivate strong like social capital and bequeath knowledge to future generations. But now, in the society we live in, it's very much sterile, childless. People have very high time preferences and don't even care about the future orientation. So what you're going to see is just more instability, and you're going to see some of the worst aspects of human behavior manifest themselves as things get more transactional. Because when you have a society that is just consumeristic and transactional in nature, loyalty just goes out the window. You're basically dealing with people not as like human beings, but as more like utils, you know, like economic units. And that to me is like, is not a society I want to live in, frankly.
Yeah, you know, what's funny is that I think this kind of goes to the larger point, and I think you were kind of making this point a little bit earlier too, where politics really is kind of like a tribal thing, at least in the current state that we live in. And kind of to what you were just saying there, I think is we industrialize more and more and more. I was talking to David Patrick Harry about this the other week. You know, we have less and less kids because, you know, they become a little bit more of like a commodity.
Yes. But
now, you know, it's, you know, our government is so large and there's so much, you know, power and, you know, boot on our neck essentially, and inflation, that like, okay, well now, you know, you're so restricted in how you can operate, you know, your business and your daily life in a way that like, not like, you know, I want to go wave my dick in front of kids. Like the fact that like, I just want to be able to go to my job, have enough money to put shit away in the bank, play music on the weekends, drink some alcohol, you know, cook, eat decent food. That's all I'm asking for. But, you know, I look at my taxes and my check and it's like, you know, they're taking 30-40% of my income, higher than that, you know, plus all the tax I spend in the store. So really it does kind of put us back into more a tribal nature where like, what can we do to fix this as soon as possible rather than thinking in the long term. But, you know, at a certain point you do have to say, okay, well, what can we do right now to fix the problem? And, you know, putting a stop to mass migration, you know, finding different ways, you know, maybe through market competition or other currencies to help kind of bring back, you know, a little bit better of a standard of living for people might be something. But I mean, you know, we're in such a clusterfuck right now that really, once again, it's just, like you said, it's very, very tribal and people are very, very reflexive in how they think about issues and politics.
Well, one thing you mentioned, Kyle, about like inflation. Inflation is more than just an economic phenomena that destroys like your country's economic standing, like among like the IMF or like whatever like organization charts economic growth or whatever. It's actually a civilizational destroying mechanism, because when you have a debased currency, nobody's going to save. And they're going to just live in the moment. And they start engaging in all sorts of wild asset speculation. Because, like, dude, saving in an inflationary context is just, like, it's a one-way ticket to getting impoverished. I'm from, originally from Venezuela, so I can kind of speak to that, given how that country's been multiple decades of mass inflation. But the thing about small business too, small businesses are not only the backbone of the economy, they're oftentimes a really good meeting spot for people in the community to congregate, not just do business, but also like chat with people.
Networking.
And catch up. Yeah, networking. And And when I don't think it is just some mere coincidence that elites in the US, they specifically implement regulatory policies to destroy small business, whereas big businesses can comply with those regulatory costs because they have such massive resources and everything. And the end result is that you're going to be like just shopping at the bank core, this lifeless corporation or whatever, Globo Corp, where, after all these small businesses get destroyed. I mean, you saw with the sweet and sour sickness how all these massive amounts of small business closures during that time. And that's not like that. That is a concerted, that is very much concerted public policy drive to consolidate the economy into this very managerial, neoliberal, monopolistic system that is just completely antithetical to what a functioning society should look like.
Yeah, it's funny. My dad actually dropped by here in the chat. You mentioned networking, and he owns his own shop. He said, yeah, everyone knows where beer is in the fridge. Now, my dad does not drink while he's working, but you know, I remember him showing me his credit card bill, and this was probably almost 10 years ago now, and he was like, yeah, look at this. He showed me all the transactions from credit cards where they hit you, okay, you know, this bill is $20. They charge you a buck here, buck there, $20 here, $40 here. As the transactions get bigger, the credit card companies charge you a fuck ton every single transaction that you do. And then when he mentioned that he called them to, you know, ask them about some of these charges, like, oh yeah, hey, you know what, we'll waive these. And you now charge a shop fee, so that way we'll kind of help you cover this. So it's like these credit card companies, these big banks, they're slimy and they know they're slimy. Yeah, he said it's also amazing how resilient small businesses. We were there when your big dealer laid you off. Yeah, well, that was the story for 2020. But yeah, these credit card companies are a lot slimier than I think even you and I realize. And they know it.
Every time, yes. I did work at this one conspiracy bookstore in Austin, defunct. I was actually right across UT, and when I went to UT, and I saw a lot of that nickel and diming with the whole credit card company system. Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, the U.S. is turning into a low trust society as well. So you're seeing this seep into every interaction, whether it's the girls that you're dating to the people you do business with. Everything has gotten like debased and degraded where you can't really trust people. And that's why also people go tribal. You see people really sort of click up a lot and not really want to mingle with other people because there's a general assumption, which I actually don't think is that unfounded, that the next person that you probably interact with is probably a piece of shit, and you don't really know, especially when you go into business, because having been in many business ventures or whatever, you really do start to see people's true colors when you start breaking bread with them and working with them as a business partner. And this is not good for our society, because if we continue this low social trust route, we simply will not be able to keep the lights on, to be quite honest.
Well, yeah, because I mean, really, you know, what's the purpose of staying here when, you know, it's not affordable to have a family here in this country? You know, your social networks are completely broken down. You can't really find a job. You can't buy a house. I mean, really, we've really destroyed. I mean, this is where somebody like Steve Bannon, who I vehemently disagree with on like foreign policy and a lot of his economic stuff. But, you know, he was absolutely right when he pointed out that like we've really destroyed this country for people in our generation. Like, you know, I'm doing good enough and I'll be 30 here in like, Jesus Christ, 4 months. But like, you know, if I look at kids who are 10 years younger than me, I'm like, man, good luck to you guys. And, you know, the dating market's awful.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm 34, and I'm doing quite well in terms of wealth and health. But, like, a lot of it is just literally me just living on the internet a lot and taking and implementing contrarian advice. Because if you follow the typical rule book and instruction manual that society dictates, like, that is the methadone clinic to mediocrity, to be quite honest. And you will be led down a blind alley. And yes, for Gen Z and, like, oh, good Lord, Gen Alpha, I mean, dating prospects, man. I mean, that's like a whole other can of worms. And I mean, yet, like, that's like one of the final, like, nails in the coffins, where if this stuff does not get sorted out, like, your civilization will literally not be able to reproduce. Because I think people don't really appreciate this, because as millennials, people don't realize it's like, millennials are one of the first generations to be, like, the quote unquote, like, first, like, less sexually active. And then you've got Zoomers, which has an even bigger so-called incel demographic. I'd rather say, like, sexless, because, like, term incel has been just completely abused. But, and then, like, Gen Alpha, man, like, when you have, like, a completely, like, internet-raised demographic, it's only just going to get worse. And, yes, I do think that the ruling class and so-called elites have ultimately failed young people in general, and they have basically not bequeathed us, but thrown a nasty, like, a stink bomb on us to catch, and we're all just mired in, like, a rancid stench of civilizational decline.
Yeah, absolutely. There was something that I think you probably know him, but Buck Johnson, who runs Counterflow.
Oh, he's fantastic. I've met him several times. Great guy.
Yeah. I've been on plenty of shows with him. I'd love to meet up with him sometime. I have a whole bunch of friends down there in Texas around him, so that's definitely like on the books eventually. But him and I think it was Jason Meyer and Chuck were talking about kind of like the symbolic nature of, like, our presidents right now and our government, about how boomers essentially will not let go the ring of power, how this is a generation where, like, we have mostly people in the government now who are, like, in their 60s to, like, 80s, and there's not that many people who are, like, younger than that. So, like, you know, in a decade or two, who the fuck knows what the country's gonna look like? It's very, very interesting thing.
It's the boomer double-edged sword, because I don't dunk on boomers as hard as some people, but but yes, like, they're the public policies they support, and the foundational myths they believe in, like, dude, like, hell no, like, hit your books harder and start upgrading your political content and political consciousness. But all that aside, in terms of, like, basic competency, in terms of, like, running the economy and all of that and keeping the lights on, they are one of the last generations that is pretty competent. It is also predominantly white European extraction. So when you look at, like, Zoomers and below, it's largely more diverse, non-white, not as intelligent, and, to be quite honest, talking to a lot of small and medium-sized business owners, they just tell me they sometimes prefer older millennials and some Gen Xers, because a lot of these people are just zonked out on all manner of drugs, whether it's, like, weed or even, like, opioids and all that. Like, they just cannot function. And I think this goes beyond, like, a generational divide. It's really, in my opinion, just a really corrupt system in society that has just degraded, and there's a really strong, like, lack of leadership. And when you're being attacked in every vector, whether it's, like, the political, like, inflation destroying you, taxes and regulations destroying small businesses, and middle Americans fighting in these Zionist wars, to, like, being attacked for expressing basic masculine preferences, or being, like, the patriarch of your home and stuff like that. Like, you're just living in just a shitty society at this point. Like, you're just being attacked at every corner. And to be quite honest, I don't, like, identify, like, as an incel or, like, MGTOW or whatever label you want. But, but to be quite honest, I don't blame a lot of people, especially working class whites who just check out. Because, or, like, so-called, like, quiet quit. Because the system they're living in, like, they're literally working for what is, for all intents and purposes, a, like, Zionist-occupied entity that does not care about them at all. Belittles them, parasitically lives off their labor, and then while getting nothing in return.
Yeah, it's kind of why I have some empathy, or sympathy, I should say, for these stupid leftist college kids, because if you lived throughout our country for the last 20 years where you saw endless wars and you saw the, you know, your debt just going up and up and up, and you were lied to your entire life and told if you just go to college and get a good job, you'll be fine. And that if you just man up enough and take up enough responsibility, then all these women are going to come flocking to you. I don't blame people for saying, if this is capitalism, fuck this.
Yes.
I can't blame people at all. Because it's like you were handed a really fucking shitty plate, and everybody that was an authority to you when you were a kid steered you in the wrong fucking direction. And then you get to our age and you find out, oh, that's all bullshit. Now what? Like, I really cannot, I can't blame people for feeling like they got the short end of the fucking stick and wanting to tear all the shit down. Now, once again, their conclusions are way out there. And I disagree.
Yeah.
But, yes. But I get it.
Well, I mean, that's why you're seeing, like, if you go on Twitter, you see some of the most hardcore forms of polarization where you, like, have literal tankies on the left and then hardcore Natsocks on the right. I've actually, I've become more sympathetic to aspects of both sides, to be honest, because the liberal internationalist order, whatever you want to call it, the managerial order, neoliberal order, blah, blah. It's like mixed economy. It's just failed. It's clearly failed. Right. You can see it in terms of people just not being able to start families, the inflation, people just working dead-end jobs, and just the overall, like, social malaise and alienation people are facing. It's clearly a system that has not delivered the goods. But the question of any epoch of crisis, though, is how do we move on from here? Where do we go? And how do we correct course? And that's one of the things that I've been trying to work on. And I've generally believe that the restoration of old right.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Principles and the reassertion of the European character and just values that made the North American continent one of, like, the most hospitable regions and civilizations in human history. reasserting all of that is key to breaking from this state of economic and civilizational decline.
Yeah, you know, I really like that you brought it there because I wanted to get to this topic. But I this will tie into this. What are your thoughts on Malay and then Nayib Bukele?
So I've been to Argentina several times.
No way.
And, yeah, I lived in Chile for a bit, and I've dated several Argentinian women who I find to be fantastic. They're absolutely great. But it sucks because Argentina has had a pretty corrupt political system for decades. And it used to be a country, actually. If you were an Italian at the start of the 20th century, you, you actually had a pretty decent choice of choosing between the U.S. or Argentina. You probably would choose Argentina because of the fact that the Latin culture of Latin America is much more similar to Italy, and you didn't have as much anti-Italian sentiment like you saw during the great wave of migration. So if you were an Italian then, like Argentina was a spot, but that's changed almost. It's like the exact opposite. Now a lot of Argentinians of Italian descent, they're trying to figure, like especially young Argentinians, they're trying to figure out if they're going to go back to like their grandparents' home, whether it's like in Italy, France, or Germany. Mm-hmm. But Milei is an interesting character. He generally says a lot of good things about the microeconomy. He is a doctrinaire libertarian for the most part. I find his Zionism to just be really bizarre, to be quite honest. He's actually bankrolled by some very weird interests too, they're part of Argentina's Jewish and like pro-Zionist community there, because Argentina does have a really large Buenos Aires especially concentration of people of Jewish extraction, and because of that there are some weird, there's some weird stuff going on there. I have my theory that and this is gonna get like really big picture.
Sure.
I think Milei will deliver the goods for the most part in terms of keeping Argentina functional for like foreign investors and for people to have like somewhat of like a decent living. I don't know if it's going to become like first world or reach its potential, the potential it could have attained in the 20th century, sure. But it'll be hospitable. But I think I'm of the view that Israel, the modern state of Israel, is actually not long for this world in light of the October 7th incidents and just the many problems it has internally. Sure. It's not far-fetched to speculate that there could be an exodus from there, where many Jewish people may consider Argentina, for example, a more hospitable Argentina as a potential spot to settle down. They already have pretty sizable community there. There's no ethnic tensions whatsoever. You don't have to deal with angry Palestinians and assortment of Arabs, Muslims, and other people that have an axe to grind for you for oftentimes very legitimate reasons, mind you, contrary to what Conservatism Inc. says. And I do think Argentina may be a fallback option, especially if Milei is able to get a lot of his reforms done. But outside of that, there are worse political leaders, but I don't really care that much because my political project is more focused on like the US and not so much Argentina. And I don't know. It really boils down to also how much establishment support, how much political elite support you might have, because there have been Argentinian leaders that have tried to right the ship in Argentina before, but they end up failing. Bukele is interesting, though. He is his pro-Bitcoin stance and his combination of like really strong law and order policies makes him like a political unicorn of sorts, and he. He's willing to take on a lot of like the powers that be in the non-governmental organization industrial complex. Freaking hates him, which is great because those people are just ghouls.
Right.
And yeah, I think he has an interesting model for people to follow. He wants to turn El Salvador basically to kind of like a Singapore of Central America. I generally like him. I prefer him more to Milei. Because Milei, he just seems like a guy that was like built in a kind of like Republican right wing think tank in DC with a like a Latin American focus. And so I can speak to this too. I used to work in the NGO space in DC, and there are many so-called free market organizations that are centered around Latin American politics that boost ties between the U.S. and Latin America. And they tend to be inhabited by Republican types. And they pal around the likes of Marco Rubio and whatnot, and or like Mario Diaz-Balart, who's another neocon hack. And these people, I think they are very subversive because they just basically want to import conservatism ink to Latin America, which I do not think is a solution. Like, it is not a solution here, and it sure as hell not going to be a solution in the global south.
Sure. Yeah. The reason why I brought up Bukele and Malay, my buddy Brent, Malay is sketchy as fuck. Yeah. There's something weird about a dude, and Dan McAdams pointed this out, where he aligns with all the neocons' goals. He's chumming it up with Anthony Blinken, chumming it up with Bill Clinton. Just really, really weird stuff. He's like crying, holding his Ukraine lapel pin, and then waving the Israel flag and just all in on it. It's just very, very weird stuff. But as far as he's making Argentina like a good place for his citizens, I'm all about it. I just, that kind of stuff, I can't look past. I can't just not criticize that.
I mean, to be honest, I think with so many problems that are going on in the U.S., I just think that it's really, it just shows a lack of like serious priorities to be obsessing about what's going on in goddamn Argentina. To be honest, because like it's cool we get some free market reforms. Yeah, we could like study that like for future reference, but I just really don't care that much. I actually think what's happening in El Salvador though is much more relevant because of the crime issue.
This is what I wanted to get to. This is why I brought up Bukele, because it seems like a lot of people in our sphere, at least like more like the dissident right libertarian sphere, are really, really enamored with Bukele for good reason. And after watching his interview with watching his interview with Tucker was fascinating. And Tucker had brought up, I think when he was interviewing Thomas Massey, he said that June was the month of fathers, which like, if you said that we had a month for fathers here in the US, people look at you like you got six heads. But just to think about like the cultural relevance
in order.
Exactly. The conversation around that. Hey, we're going to have a month around fathers. He said, you know, we're going to get together and we're going to pray. And like, I'm not religious, but like, I can look at that and say he's doing something right, especially when he cleans up the streets. And it may have gone overboard, but I mean, like, if the net effect is that the average El Salvadorian has a better life because they may have went a little overboard with cleaning up the streets and shit like that, I think that's a worthy sacrifice to make. If you imprison a whole bunch of people and now their death rate, I think their homicide rate is literally lower than the US, there's something there. And there's something that I just really like.
Well, I think the thing is about El Salvador, when you live in like such a squalid condition like that, dude, like fixating about civil liberties and basic like freedoms of like liberal democracies, that's a luxury of living in a predominantly like European civilization. Like, it's not like something that's on the table for a place like El Salvador. So you gotta like muddle through there, and it's sometimes gonna get nasty, but it's generally for the better. But that's really the history of state building since time immemorial. My whole thing is, with regards to Bukele, what he's doing is more impactful than what somebody like Milei is doing. Because there's been, if you go to like Latin America or the global south, the amount of people that have done like marginal deregulation reforms and gradualist deregulation reforms are freaking dime a dozen. Like, you see this all the time in a lot of developing countries, and it's oftentimes very mixed results too. But what Bukele is doing, I would say, is groundbreaking, but it is much more decisive and more notable, because El Salvador, dude, like, it's irrelevant and it's a backwater. It's a molecular speck in the grand scheme of things, but he's at least making an effort to put it on the map, and that's saying a lot, because we do live in a time, too, where governments are not really governed by great men. They're just governed by parasitic bureaucrats that are like working in the shadows, or just like awful HR girl boss Karen types that don't know how to lead.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And that's kind of why looking at Bukele and seeing kind of people notice that he is kind of like a great man is kind of what gives me hope. And I like seeing that because it says, oh, look, this can work. If you do have somebody at the helm who's willing to, you know, take some arrows and willing to fucking, you know, go to work, you could really have something great. And I think what also gives me hope is that, like, despite how you and I have laid out in this podcast, how things may seem bleak, really the truth is people in our generation, if you do put in an honest modicum of effort and you want to work, then you could be somebody great. If you really want it, it's there for you, but it's going to require some work.
Well, yes, because if you're able to basically ignore conventional wisdom and start finding people that are switched on, whether you go to like the red pill space, the alternative finance spaces, and even like the political spaces that we inhabit, you'll be fine within 5 years. You'll, like, if you put in the work, consume the right information, and don't make stupid decisions, you'll be fine. What I'm worried about is the people that are plugged into the grid, that are still basically engaging in what is like the equivalent of believing that Santa Claus is real, this type of behavior, like that's like that undergirds the way they move and everything like that. If you just do that, like, yeah, you are screwed. But thankfully, we do have the internet, and you got to use these tools correctly instead of just nodding off like porn or like TikTok videos. Like, consume the right type of content, and that will like ultimately give you peace of mind, and also, and most importantly, make you free.
Right, right. So one other thing I wanted to talk about is I've kind of posited this before, and I think you probably know where I'm going, and I think you probably agree, but a lot of the stuff that you see people say about China is usually true about Israel. When did you, it seems like kind of where a lot of us in our sphere, once again, kind of culminate around is saying like, hey, this little country in the Middle East, there's some shit going on here. And like, we have to kind of purge this from the right-wing movement. I remember Tim Pool saying that, oh, Nick Fuentes is so bad because he's just, you know, he comes off like he hates Israel. And like, I can kind of understand where he's coming from, but he's like, oh, you know, you're going to cost Trump the election by doing this. And my thought is that you, I mean, at a certain point, we got to say, hey, you got to get rid of the cancer on the U.S. And it's not that necessarily, you know, Jewish people inherently are a cancer. It's the state of Israel and the way that they operate on our government is the cancer.
Yes.
That's exactly what it is.
The Israel issue, I've known about, I'd say almost like from the jump, because when I got into politics, I'm not just Ron Paul, but Pat Buchanan really put me on game about it.
Capitol Hill is Israeli occupied territory.
Yes, yes. He's one of the few people that really started talking about that in the 90s during his presidential runs. But I never really made it my primary focus until I started reading more from like the likes of Kevin McDonald, the author of Culture of Critique, and E. Michael Jones, when you started learning about organized Jewry, like organized Jewish interest groups. I'm talking about the groups in particular, not just like the average Jew you meet on the street, but I'm talking about more of like the elite groups, because it's going to be like a typical straw man. It's a low IQ tactic, but it's really bad faith, and it's done to like,
well, yeah, once again, the smear of anti-Semitism is used to distract away from what these people are doing. And once again, it's not to say that every single Jew you see in the world is a part of this. No, there are legitimate groups who group together and then use their identity as a shield from criticism. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and to advance a very like sectarian effort group interest. But yeah, I really started to look into the issue just more hardcore, really, in my opinion, with the election of Trump, actually, because that's when you saw like his administration got subverted. In fact, through the campaign trail in 2015 and in parts of 2016, Trump had very reasonable views about the Israel-Palestine conflict, where he believed that these two groups needed to just sort themselves out, like without much like U.S. help. That that raised some eyebrows among the leadership class. Unfortunately, he made an unholy alliance with the likes of Sheldon Adelson, the late Sheldon Adelson, may he rot in pieces, and the rest of the Zionist neocon cabal. And like his administration was just like a dud. I mean, there's been worse presidential administrations, but for what Trump was campaigning on in 2015 to what like was delivered during his presidency, it was a disappointment. And his so-called successors ain't much to write home about either. So I've been focused on that issue a lot because it is foundational when you look at the fact that Israel and the consortium of Jewish organizations that prop it up and that are very active in U.S. politics, they're involved in a lot of other fuckery, whether it ranges from going to these pointless wars in the Middle East to like the migration crisis that we see in the in Europe and the U.S., which are often facilitated by the wars that the West gets into, and then Jewish NGOs like Israel Aid facilitate by pretty much airdropping these migrants into Europe and the U.S. so that they can get rid themselves of a potential geopolitical problem in the Middle East. You start seeing like why this invade the world, invite the world, a term coined by Steve Saylor. It's part and parcel of our political order. These never-ending wars are all about fighting for the sovereignty of foreign nations, namely in this case Israel or even like Ukraine, while our border remains porous. And once the inevitable like destruction these wars bring about rears its ugly head, you've got a refugee crisis that's coming your way that is being, for all intents and purposes, expedited by this consortium of predominantly Jewish non-governmental organizations. And yes, that's one of the bigger issues of our time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always interesting because you know, the right wingers will always talk about, oh, you know, this open border, this is a big issue. And they're absolutely right. It is. But they love Israel so much, and all their elected officials say, well, yeah, you guys, I think everybody has to open their borders so that way they can take the people that we don't want. They literally look at, you know, our countries as, you know, dumping bins for them because they feel they have the right to ethnically cleanse an area of people and then take it for themselves. And then those people, well, tough luck, go to another country. Like, could we imagine if there was another country in the world that did shit like this on our tax dollars? If it wasn't our tax dollars and this was just them fighting the Middle East and they kept it to themselves, you know, I'd have more. Yeah, I mean, I want people to be treated good, but once again, it's like, whatever. That's I'm not worried about it. But it's the fact that it's being done on our dollars.
Oh, yes. I mean, there was like this one really mask off article. I think it was like late last year by two members of the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, where they were like literally saying that Europe and the U.S. should be taking in these Palestinian refugees that the October 7th, Israel's response to October 7th has created. Yeah. And I'm like first off, hell no. These Palestinians, if they're going to go anywhere, it should be like an area where they're more culturally compatible, which was probably like Arab states. And second of all, this is actually super insidious because they're framing this as a refugee type of thing when in reality, this is like this whole program is a form of ethnic cleansing, because in accepting these Palestinian refugees, these European countries in the U.S., they're complicit in ethnically cleansing Palestine so that it can be occupied by Israeli settlers. Mm-hmm. And I want nothing to do with that whatsoever. And here's where the perpetual war angle comes. Among those Palestinians being embraced by the U.S. or Europe, there's going to be some with an axe to grind, potentially young guys that 10 to 20 years down the line, they just say, fuck it. I'm going to blow some shit up because, like, these people in the country I live in, they are literally exterminating my kinfolk in the Middle East. And you get this form of blowback. And that's the thing, too. Our foreign policy decision-making is myopic, to say the least. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is why I always try to tell people, like, look, the foreign policy stuff is very, very important, because if you want to solve a lot of the immigration issues, quit blowing up people's homes, because you're creating a huge incentive for people to come here. If you're destroying their homes, then they're going to look at our country and say, hey, that country's not getting blown up. Why don't we just go over there? And that's what's been happening. I mean, Jesus Christ, look what happens in Mexico and then all the countries in the Middle East. Of course they're coming here because, once again, their standard of living is going to be better. They're welcomed in. They can vote. They get welfare. They get a decent job, all this stuff. And then, you know, all you have to do is just leave your country that's being destroyed by us. Like, you know, it's a self-licking ice cream cone. And, you know, we're on both ends here, where we're giving them the incentive to leave, and then we're giving them the incentive to come as well. So, you know, what the hell are we doing?
Well, and to add here, because you could talk about border security all you want as a Republican and all of that, but there's always, in politics, the uncomfortable truth about revealed preferences. Because the stated preference of your typical Republican politician is strong border, strong national defense. The revealed preference, actually, when push comes to shove, is strong border, strong national defense for Israel. That's what it really is. That's the revealed preference. When it comes to shove, if you press any Republican in a high pressure legislative moment, when the rubber meets the road, they will choose the American Empire, the preservation of the Judeo-American Empire, over the preservation of the historic American nation. Like, take that to the bank.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. I always say, when I see people saying America first, in reference to Trump, it's always Israel first, you know, probably Ukraine second, Taiwan third, and then maybe you have America fourth. America's way down there. But Israel's always going to be number one every single time. I mean, now his new thing, and it is kind of funny. I do have to give it to Trump on this one. During the debates, he called Biden a bad Palestinian. I'm like, I mean, Biden is like, he's as Zionist as it gets. Yeah. He just kind of like throws out the little red meat to keep the more radical leftists who hate Israel at bay. But I mean, to his core, the dude's received the most money from AIPAC out of any political candidate ever. I think he received more than, I think, 2.5 times as much as Hillary Clinton received. So, and she's the second highest recipient of AIPAC aid or AIPAC money. And I'm sure he's gotten money, you know, elsewhere from other organizations. But it's funny that Trump, once again, wants to run essentially, I don't know if you'd say to the right of everybody else on Israel, and say that, you know, oh, well, Biden's leaving Israel behind, so I'm going to do this much more for Israel. And, you know, the fact that, like, most, you know, regular old run-of-the-mill Republicans don't see this and say, like, what the fuck's going on here? It blows my mind. I did have a little bit of a good moment, though, because my bass player, I love the dude dearly, but he's a big Trump supporter. And we were just kind of talking about it this past weekend. He's like, man, fuck Israel. I'm like, that's my guy.
So to add on here, really, the thing about America first, there's ways that this can be co-opted, because really, when you look at Republicans that are that push that mainstream Republicans that are now catching on to that, is really American empire first. There's a more, yes, there's an obsession with maintaining American primacy at the global stage, which, if you actually look at it objectively, has not benefited the American people whatsoever. Like, especially the middle Americans. Like, maybe the coastal elites. Yes, the coastal elites and those people that are plugged into the military and financial sectors. But for middle America, you get fuck all. Like, it's just, you get scraps. And the problem with the America First is that it has been co-opted. Because really, if you're genuinely America First, you're thinking about, like, the U.S. If you're going to think about foreign policy, you should be thinking about border security and maybe the U.S.'s traditional sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere under the Monroe Doctrine. But, like, when you start talking about, like, China, Ukraine, and Israel, you're talking about places that are, like, thousands of freaking miles away that pose, like, no threat whatsoever. Like, the U.S. has one of the largest nuclear arsenals on the goddamn planet, and then two moats in the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. Like, nobody's invading us anytime soon. Well, I take that back because of our porous border, but that's also, like, a very controllable issue if we had the right political class. But, like, in terms of, like, military imposition of force, like, it just doesn't pass the laugh test when people are just fear-mongering about, like, China, Iran, Russia, or whomever is, like, the monster of the week.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because none of those three countries have the ability to project force beyond their own borders. I mean, Jesus yeah. Christ, China can hardly even maintain their border with India. So, I mean, I think India just surpassed China in the amount of people. And I've been listening to the book Unrivaled, which is just a fantastic read. Very, very interesting book. And it's funny because it's written by a think tanker, Michael Beckley. And he covers just China's economy. And basically, like, their numbers are generally inflated. But even when you go by their own numbers, they're not doing too hot. So, and once their military, it sounds and looks good. But once again, if they ever even came close to us, we'd smoke them off the face of the planet. And you know, to a small degree too, if we ever tried to go over and, you know, help Taiwan maintain their independence, we would get fucked up too. I mean, we would, I think the estimates from Lyle Goldstein, like, we would lose 3,000 people in a month or something like that. And it's like, yeah, if you don't think the nukes would start flying after 3,000 Americans got killed by China in the South China Sea, yeah, you're crazy, especially not with Trump or Biden at the helm.
Yep. I mean, it's a lunacy to be talking about this whole Cold War 2.0 thing. I have, like where I tell people is with regards to China, I'm more interested in restricting Chinese migration and decoupling trade, U.S. trade with China, but and instead focusing more on trade, like, in the Western Hemisphere. But I don't think, like, any of those issues should be, like, the lead up for, like, a war, like, whatsoever. It should be linked to that. That's just absurd. And that's like Pat Buchanan's position ultimately as well, like, is what I push for. But yes, I do think though that a lot of this America First stuff is has all, like, the trappings of an op to divert otherwise legitimate political grievances into, like, a disastrous geopolitical venture in East Asia that could really accelerate the U.S.'s decline. But again, we're ruled by a lunatic class of people, so anything is possible.
Yeah, man. Well, I know you wanted to keep it to, like, an hour, so I think that's probably as good a place as any to wrap it up there. Jose, brother, I really, really enjoyed this. Go ahead, let everybody know where they can find you, support you, all that good stuff, and we'll close her out.
Well, thank you so much, Kyle, for having me on. You can find me on X at Jose El Nino. There's where I just sound off on all the craziness that's going down And then you could check out my newsletter, Jose Nino Unfiltered, on Substack, josbcf.substack.com. And that's also where you can find my podcast as well, El Nino Speaks, where Kyle's been on twice. So, and I'm also on, that podcast is also on iTunes and Spotify.
Nice, man. Yeah. Well, everybody, make sure you go check out his show, because I've enjoyed your sounds off. They're nice little quick bites where you just kind of sound off about, you know, an issue that you're thinking about at that particular time. Real nice and just, you know, quick, easy to consume. I've enjoyed that stuff, and I've enjoyed your other episodes. I just listened to your one with Safety the other day, which was a very, very interesting episode. Yeah.
Yes, he's fantastic. Yes. I'm glad to count him as actually a close acquaintance too.
Yes. Oh, nice. Yeah, dude, that's awesome. Yeah, man. Well, I think we'll wrap there if you don't got anything else.
Oh, it's all good, man. Thank you so much again.
Cool. Of course. All right, everybody. I think that's all I got. Make sure you go over comiccrown.com, all the links below where you can find Jose and all his stuff, and become a channel member for $2.99, where you could see all of the Common Crown's live performances, including the two from this past weekend. And with that, everybody, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.